Now hear this, now hear this. The final week of Quanta Camp begins at 0500 with a 20-mile run in full gear, a swim across Lake Quantitude, and 1,000 each of push-ups, sit-ups, and squats. We will then muster under the flag, where Sergeant Q will lead us in an arts and crafts project, where we will paint pithy truisms on driftwood about advice for overcoming imposter syndrome. This will also give you a gift for your families when they come to pick you up later today. Carry on.
Hey there, I have a story for you.
Okay, I love your stories.
All right. I don't know if I've ever told you this one. I got an email one time from one of your students. I had presented down there at Chapel Hill. You were kind enough to invite me down, and I gave a talk. And one of your students had emailed me and confessed that she could not tell the difference between me and Kevin Grimm. She thought that we... She thought that we were basically twins separated at birth, and she really couldn't tell the difference between the two. A little while later, after I had presented there at Chapel Hill, and we'd had a chance to interact, we were hosting one of our workshops, since we have a workshop series at Maryland, and she signed up for it and came up in person at the workshop. I got a badge that said Kevin Grimm, and I was just wearing it around. She gave me a polite nod as she came in. Oh, hi, you know, and then she went and sat down in the workshop. And she sat up in the front row and I sat in the back row since actually, you know, I was sort of the ghost facilitator of this particular workshop. About a half hour later, I get a ping in my email box and it's from her. And she says, "You cannot do that to me before I've had coffee. I just figured it out." So for a half hour, she'd really been thinking that I was an imposter Kevin Grimm. And I have to tell you, sometimes I do feel like an imposter Kevin Grimm.
I don't think I ever told you this one. My daughter has used you as an imposter. I was up to visit you. I don't know. It was pre-pandemic. I don't know when it was. But you live, as you are likely aware, right across the street mm-hmm. from a public park with a lake. Mm-hmm. And you and I will walk around that. And you and I were walking around. And we took a selfie. And I texted mm-hmm. it to my family. And I said, "Greg says hi. We're having fun. I'll check in later." Well, my daughter looked at the picture and she texted it out to her friend group and she said, mm-hmm. "OMG, my dad is hanging out with Martin Freeman."
The Martin Freeman.
Uh-huh. The Hobbit, right? The guy who plays uh-huh. the Hobbit. But they're also, uh-huh. her friend group is addicted to the BBC Sherlock Holmes. And if anybody out there hasn't seen it, it is absolutely amazing. What's the guy's first name? Cumberbatch.
Benedict Cumberbatch is Sherlock.
And Martin Freeman is Watson. And it's really a remarkable show. But her whole friend group lit up with like, "Oh my God, I can't believe your dad is hanging out with Martin Freeman."
Really?
For anybody listening right now, uh-huh. if you're in front of a computer, go ahead and just go to Google Images and type Martin Freeman and take a look, uh-huh. and then go to Google Images and type Greg Hancock, and they really are twins separated at birth.
Not even close.
All right, although, we will take a poll on this. Just go ahead uh-huh. and take a look.
Whatever. In Love Actually, he played a porn stunt double, I'm just saying.
Oh, that was a great movie. I love that movie.
It is a wonderful movie.
And he was a very shy porn stunt double. Anyway, so yes, you have several doppelgangers out in the world. Now, I do have to say, as further evidence that you were a man never to be trusted, I was also up in Baltimore at a conference that you were overseeing, or at least had your fingerprints on. And when mm-hmm. you checked in, you got the conference swag, a canvas bag filled with all sorts of stuff, and it had a picture on the side of the society emblem. And so I said, "Thank you very much." And I took it and I walked around and I used it for a couple of days. And people began asking me, "So how did you like your bag? Was it a cool bag? Did you like your bag?" And I'm like, "It's a freaking bag. I will throw it away when I leave. I throw all of this stuff away when I leave. I'm trying to be polite and not throw it away right in front of you." And at some point you finally said, "Would you please go up to your hotel room and look at your bag?" And I go up and I look at the side, and maybe a year or two earlier, Chris Preacher was in town in Chapel Hill, and we were at Dan Bauer's house, and we decided to send you a holiday text message. And so Chris and I, for no reason at all, stood in front of the Christmas tree and with dour looks flipped off the camera. And we then texted it to you and said, Chris and I are sending you our holiday wishes. And this photo is what is emblazoned on the bag, is Chris Preacher and I flipping off the camera. So really, the walkaway point is at no point can you be trusted ever.
It's true, man. It's whatever you send my way is going to come back at you one day or another.
This could be a nice entry point into the conversation for what I might point out is the final week of Quanta Camp.
Dun, dun, dun.
Okay, I'll slice in something a little better than that. So you and I have decided this will be the last week, and then we'll take a bit of time off and come back at the start of the fall semester with the first episode of season two. But let's think very briefly about what we've done here in Quanta Camp. So I'm actually going to pull up the webpage because I don't remember. All right. Mm-hmm. So May 11th, believe it or not, May 11th was the call to arms. Henry V and St. Crispin's Day and all of that wonderful thing. Then we moved in on June 1st. We started with developing a research idea, then choosing a journal, then doing quant research using existing data, then writing a pedagogical paper, building a quant culture within your home department, enhancing diversity in the quant sciences, and then the episode that dropped just a couple of days ago is being a lifelong learner in quant. What I would pitch is now that you have dedicated your summer to becoming a quantitative leader in your field, in recognition of this, Greg and I proudly present you with, you now feel like an imposter.
A total poser, a wannabe, absolutely.
This is in recognition of a job well done. Congratulations.
Congratulations.
You now feel like you don't belong here.
Uh-huh. Welcome to the club.
Oh, you ain't a kidding, man. Welcome to the club. Because drawing on my clinical skills, I can offer a little helpful advice. Tough crap, it never goes away.
I will tell you another little story. And this was when I was in maybe the fifth year of my career as an assistant professor, which means I had done many conference presentations, which means I had actually been a teacher in a prior life. Every time I was about to give a conference presentation, I would have given the talk in my hotel room a dozen times. I would set a chair on top of the bed and use it as a lectern, and I had my notes, and I would go over it and over it. There was no reason I really needed to be doing that, but I felt like I shouldn't be there. And I had this one conference where I was not going to be the presenter. One of my students was going to be the presenter. And I got a call the night before from his wife saying that he had injured his back and wouldn't be able to come to the conference. I developed a presentation, practiced the presentation all night, printed off the transparencies, that dates it, of course, and rolled into the conference the next morning. Sure enough, at 8 a.m., as the session is about to start, the student comes into the presentation. And I see him and I go, what the heck are you doing? And he said, better living through chemistry. And I said, well, I'm completely prepared to do this. He looked at my slides. He looked at the slides that he brought. They called his name and he gives me his slides, takes my slides, goes up there and delivers this wonderful presentation. And he had the confidence. Now, the fact is he had been a lieutenant colonel in the Air Force. And he could just, but he had put in 10,000 hours at something, and I had put in 10,000 hours at something. And he went up there with such incredible command, and I felt like I was faking it every single time I gave a presentation. And at that moment, I realized, why is it that he has so much confidence in something that he has never done, and I have zero confidence in this? Why do I feel like such a fraud? And at that moment, I just said, there's no reason for me to be this way anymore. And I literally tried to train myself to fake confidence in what I am doing.
You and I collectively have been in the field more or less for half a century, and I still feel like I don't belong here. I still feel like somebody is going to figure me out. Maybe I've tamped that down a little bit over the years, but not even just noticeable difference. Talk to me a little bit about your view of this. Is where do you think it comes from, and what do you do yourself to manage this?
Where it comes from, I'm not exactly sure if it's part personality type, part the nature of being in an academic field where the field is constantly expanding, as we talked about last time. I don't know if it's that I have this perfectionism that can be problematic, quite honestly. And I have to do this self-talk, you know, you're good enough, you're smart enough, and you know what? Do you remember Stuart Smalley?
I'm going to do a terrific show today, and I'm going to help people because I'm good enough, I'm smart enough, and doggone it, people like me.
I still sort of go through that.
Feeling like an imposter is, by definition, a contextual evaluation, right? Mm-hmm. If I'm among a bunch of six-year-olds, I really don't feel like an imposter. I feel pretty confident about where I am and what I know.
You're the best six-year-old there could be.
Exactly. So I dominate a first-grade class. But my very same me then walks into a psychometric society meeting, and I sit in between Peter Bentler and Jim Steiger, and I feel like it's a miracle that I can breathe unassisted. Mm-hmm. And it's the same me, my same knowledge, mm-hmm. the same person, but mm-hmm. in a first grade class, I feel utter and absolute confidence, but in another setting, I feel completely incompetent, and I believe genuinely that I don't even deserve to be there. So it's an interesting concept, because I really do think it's contextual. But not only is it contextual in the physical space, but I think it's even more so contextual inside your head. So one of the things I talk to my own students about when talking about this issue is you have to compare yourself to people who are at your level, where you are professionally. You have to compare yourself to your peers when you think about this. I am cursed with where I work because I walk down the hallway and I pass Dave Thissen, and then I pass mm-hmm. Ken Bolin, and then I pass Dan Bauer, and I get to the stairwell and I'm like, I should just go to my car and just go home and just give it up. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's part of it. So I find it a vexing problem because it really is in your head.
So between the two of us, one of us has a degree in psychology. And perhaps that one of us who has a degree in psychology might actually offer some useful tips for people to manage imposter syndrome. Should we ask if the person with a degree in psychology has some actually useful tips for this?
Well, I think my wife is on a Zoom call herself, but I could go check if she... Honey? Uh-huh. Honey? No, uh-huh. She's not answering back. Okay. So I guess I could talk about my training in psychology because uh-huh. I'm pretty well trained at that. No, I am not going to take any kind of professional perspective on it, but I can mm-hmm. share how I've tried to wrestle with it myself. The main one for me is we're all happier people if we realize that you can't control what other people think about you. Right. The whole thing about imposter syndrome is you feel about this yourself. So how can we even define imposter syndrome? For lack of a better term, you can talk about imposter syndrome being the inability to believe that success is due to your own skills. To me, the operative term in there is the inability to believe. Is this mm-hmm. is an internal process that we all struggle with ourselves. For me, what it distills down to is not entirely, but a large part of it is an issue of self-confidence. It goes back to your story with the lieutenant colonel. The term you sometimes get in music, and I don't like it just because I don't like any rhymey terms, but it's a very common one, is fake it till you make it, mm-hmm. right? And I don't know why people Driftwood. Are motivated to come up with rhymey things. Right, there's a Driftwood. There's Driftwood number one. Let's keep track of it, because I do think this is going to become a Driftwood episode.
Okay.
And so for $18 on Ocracoke Island, you can get one that says, fake it till you make it. Uh-huh. If you can set the annoyance of the rhyminess aside, I really do think that's a core component of this. Mm-hmm. There is a self-confidence, but it's on a continuum, and all of us know people either in our social spheres or in our professional spheres that over overly take that to heart. And at some point, it transitions into rigid arrogance.
Mm-hmm.
You got to find that sweet spot where you are confident in what you know and you are confident in what you have to share with others, but you also know your limitations and you know your boundaries.
I don't hate fake it till you make it. I do that all the time. The very first time that I taught structural equation modeling, after having had to teach it to myself, I had a class of 40 people, the majority of whom were faculty. I swear I was one page ahead each week. It was all I could do to get out the door, to figure stuff out, to go into that room and explain stuff, and then collapse after the class. Okay, I fooled them this week, but oh my God, I don't know how I'm going to fool them next week. And then I'd go learn more stuff. We do this all the time. I will buy that driftwood. I will mount that driftwood on my wall because I do that all the time. And you have to just say, you know, I'm doing the best I can. I might be faking it in some spots. I might not be completely confident in other spots. But every person out there who has been with us throughout QuantiCamp, where we are trying to say, hey, you can do this. Hey, you can become more quantitative. You can aspire to be a quantitative leader in your own field. You can help to elevate the quantitative sophistication with your own field. Please, please know that we're all just kind of getting through, figuring it out as we go. I hope that that's a positive thing rather than thinking, wow, they don't even know what they're doing. You should think, wow, they don't even know what they're doing.
And being one page ahead is all you need. It's come up before. I'm a baseball fan, and you can have a home run that is a towering shot into the upper deck. And you can have a home run that bounces off the top of the outfield fence and drops into the bullpen. And they are both home runs.
Yes.
I aspire to be one page ahead. That's efficient. That's realistic. But you alluded to something that I think is core here. Our science is embedded within skepticism, criticism, and rejection.
Mm-hmm.
I would buy that driftwood. You can have your cutesy, rhymey thing. I would buy the one that says skepticism, criticism, rejection.
Yeah.
And I like that. I'm going to make one of those. That's the cornerstone of what we do. We had a whole episode talking about we get rejected more than not. And the highest levels of performers get rejected routinely. But what you have to do is try to separate when you get criticized at a conference, when somebody expresses skepticism of an idea you have. Are they being critical and skeptical of the idea, or are they being critical and skeptical of you and your knowledge and your being in that situation at that time? And I would argue that one of the core components to imposter is someone can express skepticism about an idea that I then internalize, that they think I don't belong here, that they think I'm not smart enough, that they think I'm not really a quantitative person. And so it's that internal-external attribution. We are all empirical scientists, and one of my recommendations would be try to stay focused on what you can objectively observe that's related to this issue. I gave my very first quant presentation at a conference at Psychometric Society. I still remember it as clear as if it were a couple of days ago. It was at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver, and it was the very first what I would call real quant presentation I gave.
Mm-hmm.
And it was on the RMSEA. There's a long version of the story. The short version is this incredibly fit, big, handsome man raised his hand. And he said, tell me how you computed the RMSEA. And I said, the RMSEA you compute by taking the chi-square minus degrees of freedom divided by the degrees of freedom times n minus 1, and you take the square root. And there was a pause, and he said, son, I'm James Steiger. I know how to compute the RMSEA. I almost blacked out. I mean, it's like what they teach you in Colorado. If you encounter a bear, you just go ahead and curl up in a ball. And if you're lucky, he'll snort around you and walk away. And I was like, well, if I curl up, maybe he'll come and snort around me and then just kind of wander away. And Jim and I became friends, and he became a senior mentor to me. And if you don't know Jim, first, he's a remarkable human being. But second, he really was the original developer of the RMSEA. Mm-hmm. And others expanded it in different ways, but Steiger and Lynn back in...
1980 conference paper.
Mm-hmm. My point is, it had nothing to do with me. His question was about... analytically, in the simulation, how did I calculate the RMSEA? Yet I almost started weeping in front of a room full of people because I thought he was questioning my knowledge. And so the big thing I talk to my own students about is differentiating the idea from the person, the objective from the subjective. That, I think, is one of the cores of dealing with this as an issue.
I, too, have been on the business end of questions from Jim Steiger. The difference is I was warned going in.
Oh, I had idea who he was. And it doesn't help at all that the dude is like 6'4", 220 pounds, with 0% body fat.
Yes, a metal exoskeleton.
But you know what's amazing about Jim? Actually, I hadn't thought about this before, but Jim, I think, is a really nice example of this very point that I had, because he slapped me all around the room during that presentation, because that wasn't the end of it. I told him how I computed it, and then it went back and forth and back and forth. And afterwards, he came up, and I was like, oh, crap, this guy's going to punch me in the face. I mean, because now we're within reaching distance.
He's just getting warmed up.
And, oh, my God, he was the nicest, kindest. Yeah. And he was like, I really like that. I like the direction you're going. This is really wonderful. And I hadn't thought about that before in the way that we're talking about it here. But he himself objectified that he punched me in the face with respect to a specific idea, a specific thing. But when he came up, he was nothing but positive and supportive of this junior person who was at his very first quant conference. But he very clearly separated the idea from the person.
And I think that's an important point that we made, I think back in episode 15, Academia and the Chamber of Secrets, maybe, about how supportive people actually are of you. You might see these people as terrifying and smart and all of that, but a lot of it's a construction in your head. And they are generally very, very caring. They have enough long view to know that here is a person who is potentially going to be the next generation of leaders in our field. You don't tend to think of it that way because you're too young. You don't see it from their view. But I love seeing young scholars giving presentations early on. It's so much fun. And I try not to beat up on them. I try to have motivating conversations with them afterward. I think people are so supportive out there, and we tend to not realize that when we're in the heat of battle, that the people out there actually really want us to succeed. It's easy for me to say that when I'm talking to a younger person. Ironically, it's hard for me to feel that as a person in a room giving a talk. But I'm working on it. I'm faking it till I make it.
Can't you just lose the rhymey part? Fake it till you achieve success. Fake it until you dominate others. I would buy that one. Fake it till you dominate those around you. I'll hang that just below criticism, skepticism, rejection. I don't want to belabor this as a tie, but in any wind instrument, when you most need to take a giant breath and to fill the trumpet with air is when you're least likely to do that. And what I mean is, if you have a part that's important that's coming up, maybe a solo, this is something I've struggled with for years. You become more timid. You take kind of a shallow breath. You don't move very much wind through the trumpet. And it vastly increases the probability that you're going to fail in what you're trying to play because you don't have the breath behind it. You don't have the air. And I see a direct parallel with this is that Lieutenant Colonel story, going up and taking a deep breath and filling your instrument with air through your self-confidence and your belief that you deserve to be there. I really do feel like it's having confidence in yourself and your abilities and knowing their limits, right? We're never going to be a Michael Brown because there was only one Michael Brown. You can have aspirations, but still feel confident that this is what I can do and this is what I can contribute and I belong here.
Because I'm good enough, I'm smart enough,
all of this is talking about my own struggles with this, because I'm 30 years into this career and I feel this way all the time. I get articles to review where the editor will write back channel and say, I need you to be the swing vote on this, as I've got two reviewers who like it, two reviewers who hate it. I need you to weigh in and break the tie. And functionally, you're saying, all right, you decide if this should be accepted or not. And I'm like, I have no freaking ability to adjudicate this. This is a horrible decision on your part to send me this paper. Yeah. And this happened a couple of weeks ago. This wasn't like, oh, I remember when I was in it. This happened a couple of weeks ago. Is an AE said, I need you to break a tie. And I was like, you are a horrible AE and you should not be in this job.
Wait a minute. Was this one of my papers again?
Did you tie it to power? Because you write a whole lot of crap that you don't tie to power. For me, there are two things that strike at this perceived imposter syndrome. One is, for most people, not everybody, but for most people, it never goes away. This is a lifelong problem, and I feel this way absolutely every day. Talking about realistic expectations, it's not something to say, well, how do I make this go away, but how do I manage this feeling? How do I make this part of who I am? Because I have to tell you, people who struggle with imposter syndromes are the people who you like to hang out with. They're the people who you see as the good guys in this field, right? Because if you don't have imposter syndrome, then you're walking into a room with the belief that you're the smartest person in the room. You are going to enlighten people around you. You are the voice of reason in the desert of ignorance. Nobody wants to go out to dinner with that person. The person you want to go out to dinner with is like, oh my gosh, do you know what Steiger said to me and when I was in there? And so one is it never goes away. And two, and I really do feel this, is I think this is a good problem to have. I think imposter syndrome is a good problem to have, because what it means is you're pushing yourself. You're putting yourself at risk. You're going out to the edge of your comfort zone and maybe stepping over that. And then you move that comfort zone out a little bit more. Again, if you're only hanging out with six-year-olds, this is not a problem that you have. But let me tell you where it sometimes transitions to a bad problem. And I can speak from personal experience on this. Everything we've talked about up to this point is perceptions. It's how you feel. It's that you don't belong at the party. You don't belong at the table. All of that is struggling with your own demons. Well, I got to tell you, I have been in positions in which I have had a real imposter syndrome, not a perceived one, but I have been in over my head. And I think that is an interesting corollary to the imposter syndrome. I have been at grant reviews where the chair has turned to me and said, so did they propose their analytic strategy correctly? And 20 people turn to you. I'm in not rural North Carolina, but I'm up on the north side of town. Deer are everywhere. And driving home is you have to drive at like 20 miles an hour because deer like dance the conga out in front of my house. And I just felt like one of these deer that the lights were on and you just freeze, right? And then get mowed down by the car. I had no freaking idea. I have had an advisor turn to me in a dissertation committee when the student is out of the room and say, should we pass them or not?
Right.
I have no freaking idea. I can't tell you how many disappointed colleagues I have had over the years who have come in and said, do you have 2 minutes? And then they write some preposterous, ridiculous problem on the board that they're wrestling with. And you look at it and you say, I have no idea. I have no idea what you're talking about. And then to a person, they're like, oh, I thought you'd know. And they just shuffle out the door.
Disappointed.
Disappointed. I have disappointed half my colleagues. And I really have no point here other than you can get yourself in a position where you are over your head. And what that leads me to, and I've been in this position repeatedly, is I feel like you can do one of two things. is you can say, okay, I overreached on this and I need to take a step back. I am invited as an ad hoc reviewer to be the quant person on the biostats review group at NIH and to say, I'm really sorry, I'm not available, right? I've done that. Is I've said, I can't land this plane. I don't have the training. I'm not going to get in the cockpit. So that's one option, is just take a step back. But the other one goes back to what we were talking about a bit last week, which is, what is a mantra from my own life? And I would buy a crappy piece of driftwood with this on it, which is, I'm better than I was, but I'm not as good as I want to be. When you're in that position of being over your head, do you use that as a motivation to say, okay, what am I going to do where I'm not in this position? Do I keep pushing myself? So do you take a step back or do you take a step forward? Do you wrestle with that?
All the time. As I mentioned last week, I tend to actually engineer situations where I am incompetent for the purpose of motivating myself to try to elevate to that.
I think we clearly agreed that that was an awful strategy. So yes, I am aware of that.
Other than making me an honorary Irish Catholic, yes, it might be a horrible strategy. But that's how I choose to try to elevate myself. I put myself in situations where I have to fight my way out. And I have to learn things to be able to do it. And that's just what works for me, whether it's by facilitating my own guilt, by making a stack of journals that I have to read, or taking on a project that involves things that I'm not especially expert in. That's the way I manage my own being in over my head, because I will work so that I won't be in over my head, so that I can at least get my head above water and suck in a couple of gasps before I go under again. And I know this. I know this about me. I know that I will be in over my head. It is part of the whole deal. If you were never in over your head, you either never went swimming at all, or you are the most knowledgeable person completely. And I will never be the most knowledgeable person. And I'm not in this position to become the most knowledgeable person. I'm in this position to always be learning. And always learning means that you are in a position where you don't know things. And I am extremely happy to be in that kind of position.
In a way, we have put quanta campers in a dangerous position because we've led them down the gilded path of becoming a quant leader in your field. What do you say to those foolish enough to get to the very end of the pier and looking at the icy cold lake of saying, I kind of like this. I wonder if I could be good at this. What's next?
That's not unfamiliar, right? As we talked about in the very first season of Quantitude, that nobody comes to our field in any kind of linear fashion. Typically, they find us while they're doing other things. In fact, I had a conversation just yesterday with someone at an institution who is in a faculty position in another area who is saying, I just really like the number stuff so much more than the other stuff I'm doing. I have conversations with people who are in graduate programs, earning PhDs, who say, I'm in this program, but the more I learn about quant, the more I realize that that's really what I want to be doing. And so what about those people who are out there who have been with us maybe throughout the whole first season of Quantitude, maybe throughout this summer in Quanticamp, who are saying, I do want to do that. I know I'm doing this other thing, but I do want to do that. We should maybe talk about those people.
You know how I view it sometimes? What is your opening paragraph? Whether it be in a manuscript, whether it be in a dissertation, whether it be whatever that you're doing, your opening paragraph. Is your opening paragraph setting up a substantive question? And then your second paragraph opens with, here we use a recently developed method to evaluate our proposed hypotheses in ways not previously possible. That's option A. And option B is, at some point you transition where your opening paragraph becomes the quantitative question. Is your opening sentence is, the past 5 years has witnessed the rise of quantitative methods previously not available. One such method optimizes the separation of within and between person effects. Early indications show this is promising. However, this has yet to be applied in a complex real data set. The goal of this manuscript is to, And so I talk to my students a lot about what is your opening paragraph. It's an oversimplified microcosm, but I think that is a gating of, are you going to go right or left when you hit the fork in the road? Of, are you a quantitatively sophisticated substantive researcher, or are you transitioning to being a quantitative researcher with legitimate substantive interests?
I would say that's a very brave thing for someone to want to do, right? You're so invested in this other identity that you have created for yourself, but you feel quant tapping you on the shoulder, you know, saying, I will not be ignored. And at some point, some people make the decision to flip, to change their introductory paragraph to being from substance to quant. And I would ask maybe if we have any advice for people who are thinking about doing that, thinking about jumping into that big lake.
I just want to clarify a prior point that I made. Normally, I like clarifying points that you made, but I'll go ahead and try to be balanced and clarify my own point. I talked about a split in the road. I mean that for a particular paper or project, not a person. You don't have to trade in your ID card from being a substantive person to being a quantitative person. And indeed, we've talked on prior episodes, is many of the titans in the field are both. One of my heroes that I so deeply admire is Dave Kenny. Is Dave Kenny a substantive researcher or a quantitative researcher? The answer is yes. Is Steve Rowdenbush a quantitative researcher or a substantive researcher? The answer is yes. And so it's not like you have to pick one direction to go or another, but it is the case of, do you aspire to expanding your contributions where they might be considered a novel and unique contribution to the quantitative sciences? For me, a lot of it distills down to risk-taking. Are you willing to try to take a deep breath and stand up with your instrument and fill the horn with air and try to make this quantitative contribution? Let's do a little rhymey and do Suck It Up, Buttercup. You want to write a paper for Psych Methods? I suggest you get off your ass, switch the paragraphs, and write a paper for Psych Methods.
Good talk, Dad.
I told this story once. I don't know if it made it through post-processing or not, but where my daughter was training for a 5K or leg hurt, I told her to take a Tylenol and a hot bath because it hurts when you run. And 3 days later, we found out she had a broken leg. So I'm willing to admit that I may not be the primary source of advice when it comes into this arena.
But let's try to dispense some advice. Let's imagine that someone wants to straddle the quantitative and substantive worlds and maybe even come to favor the quantitative world a little bit. Let's offer some non-driftwood. So I talked to somebody who did this. I actually prepared, is what I'm trying to tell you. I contacted Micah Remtala.
I know Micah.
Yeah, she's terrific. She's at UC Davis. And Micah had done her doctorate in psychology, and not quantitative specifically, but she became increasingly enamored of the quantitative methods to the point where she said, I think this is really what I want to be emphasizing. And if you are finishing up your degree in an area and you are looking down the barrel of getting jobs in something that you're not entirely sure you want to do for the rest of your life, you have to make a very difficult decision. And so I asked her, how did she flip herself? How did she transition? What kinds of things did she do? And she very kindly sent me a list of wisdom that she has accrued and things that she went through. And I thought maybe I could just spout some of these off for starters. One thing she highly recommended, and this is very common, I think, in the psych arena, is to aim to get a postdoc. In psychology, I think it's more common, if not routine, for people to follow their doctoral training with a postdoc. A lot of other fields, that's not common. But I would say, as she did, that if you are going to try to transition, you need to have concerted time where you are really focusing on facilitating that transition. And in her case, she did a postdoc and where she could start focusing almost entirely on quantitative methods.
I think there should be federal legislation that requires a postdoc. I think there are so many advantages to that. Just simply having the bandwidth to start to develop your own ideas to start to learn new methods to prepare yourself for the next transition. We talked about last week where in the traditional martial arts as a black belt represents, you now have the foundational skills to truly begin the art and to truly become an expert. But the black belt is a starting point. I see parallels with a PhD. Is you now have the foundational skills, and I think a postdoc is, let's start working on your second degree, black belt, which is developing these skills in a way that you make your own, right? Part of the art is you make the art your own as you adjust to what your body type is like and what your strengths and your weaknesses are. So I totally agree with that. I have yet to meet a person who did a postdoc who doesn't look back on that fondly and say, oh, that was, I didn't realize what I had at the time.
Yeah, and there are ways to get funded for those. Sometimes it's that a particular lab is hiring. Other times you can write, for example, an NIH F-32. And the idea of the F-32, and I would imagine you've hosted some F-32s. Is that not correct?
I've had many F-32s, and I had an F-32 myself. Because I followed a similar trajectory to Micah's, and I wrote an F-32 and went and worked with Bengt Mutain at UCLA, which is what shoved me hard into this field. If I didn't go to work with Bengt, I would not be in this position. I don't know where I would be.
Yeah, it's a wonderful opportunity to help reshape yourself. And for that matter, people who are, and this might sound even riskier, right? But for those of you who are actually in faculty positions in a particular substantive area, and you really want to try to flesh out the quantitative side of what you do, it's even possible to get an NIHK award, right? Which is an award for senior postdoc fellows or faculty level candidates where you propose a whole program of study for yourself and you have to make the case about how it will elevate you as a scholar, make you more able to be competitive for major research grants, et cetera. And it is a wonderful opportunity to sort of press pause on what you're doing within your own field and start to expand yourself, reshape yourself. I think that's a phenomenal opportunity for people in the spirit of it's never too late to start over.
But I so strongly believe in that. Pull out the driftwood again, but it's never too late. Today is the first day of the rest of your life. Arrgh. It's like, yeah, okay, oh my God.
Wait, why did I become a pirate?
I don't know. I don't know why it became a pirate. Just, arrgh, today be the first day of the rest of ye life. Yeah, I don't know where that came from. I think we're 90 minutes into this and I'm starting to lose it. So maybe that was it. But I really, really strongly believe that because there was a person with whom I worked in the field who applied for a K and did not get funding and decided they were going to do it anyway. And they just made it a priority. And they went over to the stats department as a full professor and they took undergrad stats classes that they audited. They came to Chapel Hill and visited with me. So they just decided, well, they didn't get the K support. They were just going to do it anyway. But in all seriousness, if you're 50 years old and have never played the piano, you can become an accomplished pianist if you make that a priority. When you're 70 years old, which all of us have every intention of being, you could have played every day for 20 years. And imagine the piano player that you could be at 70. You and I are both a fan of The Onion, the satirical newspaper. And if not, go to theonion.com when you eat lunch. And it is one of the most entertaining things you've ever seen in your life. One of my favorite headlines of all time. It had no story with it. It was just a headline. And it said, 88-year-old man dies never knowing he was an oboe prodigy. And I actually had that on my door for a while because it's one of those things, whether you be in college and you're high and you think this or whether you be late in life and think it, but the classic, how do I know I couldn't have been one of the world's greatest cricket players? I've never played cricket. I could be pickleball champion. I could be a mandolin impresario. Well, I don't think you can be an impresario on a mandolin, but you get my point.
Could you not? He's the leading dulcimer player in all. No.
Hey, somebody has to be the best dulcimer player in the world. Okay. But my point is staying off of the driftwood, no matter where you are in your career, you can be a full named professor mm-hmm. and you can still have 10 or 20 years left in your career. And it's your choice. You could make this a priority and get these kinds of experiences. For me, it's a matter of, is that something that you want to do? Is that mm-hmm. something that's a priority to you? Is that something that you derive some enjoyment from? And if so, then make that happen.
In the things that Micah shared with me, she had a lot of ideas, small and large, and I'm not going to recount all of them, but I will underscore a theme in some of them that's already come up, and that is the importance of a mentor and collaborators, the importance mm-hmm. of working with people who have these skills. Whether you are a person in a substantive area who wants to really become increasingly quantitative, you can collaborate with people who are quantitative. You can start to work on developments by pairing up with other people who do primarily quantitative stuff, have them help you be ushered into that arena, or you can just cold call somebody, believe it or not, and see if that person can be your mentor. So it doesn't necessarily just need to be a formal relationship under the auspices of an F-32 or a K award or some other arrangement. You can just say, I have these skills. I am really interested in becoming a quantitative methodologist. Might you share with me some of your expertise, wisdom? Might you have a project that I could join you on? The person may say no, but the person might also say yes.
In support of that, I cold called banked and said, you have no idea who I am, but if I wrote this F-32 and showed up on your doorstep, would you be open to allowing me into your lab? And he said, sure. On the other end of it, one of my very favorite colleagues I've worked with is Andrea Howard, and she is up now at Carleton University. She stalked me. I was at a conference. I believe she was still a grad student. This was years ago, but she came up after a talk I gave. She introduced herself and she said, I would like to come and work in your lab. And we went and had a cup of coffee and we talked. And I said, I don't have any funding. And she said, don't worry about it. I can try to get some funding on my end. And she said, but even if I don't, I want to come down anyway. And I said, yeah, absolutely. Why not? And she showed up and she was one of the dearest people I have ever worked with. And we stay in contact. And she simply walked up to me out of the blue and accosted me at a conference. And that's what you can do.
So I have just a couple of quick points for those people who really want to try to go, if not all in, a lot more in than they already are. One is the importance of teaching experience in the quant arena. If you're in a postdoc and you can teach a class or teach some lectures in a class in quant, I highly, highly recommend it. It's good experience if you're actually ultimately trying to sell yourself as someone who does quant. It also just sharpens your understanding of how things work. So if that's available to you, I strongly recommend that you do that. And then also, in the spirit of connecting with other people, whether it's in the form of mentors or collaborators, start becoming part of quantitative communities. Within our field, it might be APS, APA, AERA, a variety of different acronyms. But many fields will have these small little niches of people who are quantitative. Start hanging out with those people. And if that kind of niche doesn't exist, then maybe you need to start creating your own quantitative group, your Swedish Society of Quantitative Corpus Linguists, or whatever it is you might create for your own area. Start creating the community, hanging out with the cool kids, because as everybody knows, we are, in fact, the cool kids. And then just more broadly, knowing that you are going to feel like an imposter when you start hanging out with these people. And you're always going to feel like an imposter. You will never know everything that is out there. There's this quote that I like from Samuel Beckett, try again, fail better. And that's how I feel about these things. You know, you keep trying it, you screw up. But you screw up a little bit better than the last time, and you keep learning all the time. I like the phrase, fail better. That motivates me. That's my driftwood.
I have 3 points. Read, read, and read. I don't mean just for content, but I also mean just look at model after model after model of how others are contributing to the field. A couple of us will start working on a project. We'll start getting some feel around the edges and kind of see what it might be and how we might might want to pursue that. And we will say, are we envisioning a psych methods paper, an MBR paper, an SEM paper, or a JEBS paper? All right, those are four flagship quant journals. Those are all different in how you would pitch the paper. And so whether you have an SEM or JEBS versus an MBR, those are different kinds of papers, and there are different ways of communicating ideas. Know what those mean. Look at JEBS papers, look at SEM papers, look at MBR papers. And so that's my recommendation. I'll dig back through the driftwood, but the fake it till you make it is just start hanging out with those who are making the kind of contributions that you want to make and see what they're doing. So those are my 3 points. Read, read, and read. Did you ever watch Hill Street Blues?
Of course.
The desk sergeant would get everybody ready for the day. And at the end, okay, so you tell me, what would he always say every time at the end?
Let's be careful out there.
Exactly. Let's be careful out there.
All right, that's it. Let's roll. Hey, let's be careful out there.
On this last 5 minutes of the last week, let's embrace trite colloquial truisms. Let's be careful out there. If you had high school graduation speech level insights to share, what would a couple of those be?
I actually gave the high school graduation speech in my high school.
Why does that not surprise me at all?
I have no idea what I said. Why don't you go ahead and do it for me? I have no idea what to say.
I am going to bulldoze through the most hollow, trite, driftwood, beach town truisms I can come up with. Take risks. Put yourself out there. Set yourself up where you might fail. We talked on a prior episode that if you look at the all-time home run leaders and the all-time strikeout leaders, there's huge overlap between those two lists. One thing the pandemic, I think, has done has reified this notion that life is calculated risks, that we walk out the door and even without a pandemic, our day is filled with risks, but we do certain things to mitigate them with seatbelts and crosswalks and red lights and approach it as a calculated risk. Have fun. None of us chose this career for money. And if you did, oh my God, are you going to be disappointed? Think about this as socially acceptable hedonism. What can you do to better enjoy your day? One that I'll yell down the hallway at the kids, at least pre-pandemic, is go outside and play with your friends, right? Get out of the house, go play, right? How many times have you either heard that or said that to your own kid? This is along those lines, is we are in a job that is incredibly risky for getting into a routine. And again, if your partner says, do you think there's a difference between a routine and a rut? Pretend like you have a minor brain aneurysm just so that you can get yourself out of that, right? Do something different to just keep things mixed up. Something I think about is what, for lack of a better term, I call legacy light, which is I hate being part of conversations, especially now that I'm kind of in my 50s and my colleagues at my level and older are, what do you want your legacy to be? It drives me insane. How do you want to be remembered? But it doesn't mean you can't be thoughtful about how you want to impact the field and how you want to make contributions to the field. And if you can identify how you want to do that, then work in a way that allows you to fill that in. And then the last one goes back to, if you want to learn the piano, get off your ass and take a piano lesson. Envision yourself in 5 years. What would you like to be? What is an idealized self? And then start doing things now to meet your future self. Greg, you and I both have had white belt students who said, well, I won't get my black belt till I'm 25. And my constant response to that is, you're going to be 25 anyway. Do you want to have a black belt or do you not want to have a black belt? Because that's what the question is. I will go ahead and speak for you, but as two men who are entering deep into their 50s, we can both attest that time goes by. Not in a sad way, I'm not lamenting the passage of time, But believe me, as you're going to wake up one morning and be 55, you have a time machine. If you're 25 or 30 or 35 or 40, you have a time machine where you can say, I am going to wake up one morning and be 55 years old. What do I want to be doing? Mm-hmm. And what do I need to do now to put me in that position? I have now filled my Ocracoke Island curio shop with the crappiest amount of beech wood. I'm done. And always dance as if no one is watching.
Huh. Okay. On that note, this brings us to the end of Quanticamp. And I can't believe we ended on dance like no one's watching. But there it is. Thanks. Thanks, Patrick. So we appreciate everybody who has been with us throughout the summer. Quanticamp was a nice opportunity for us to help communicate with folks out there who are being sucked into the quantitative world and maybe helping them out a little bit. It's also a chance for Patrick and I to do something that we love, and that is to be involved in our field and help people out there who think they want to be a part of it as well. We have huge plans for season 2 of Quantitude.
Do we? No, we don't.
We don't. Shh.
Yeah. We haven't even talked about that yet.
Yeah, so we look forward to having folks join us back with our regular program in season 2 of Quantitude. And we just wish everybody a happy and healthy rest of the summer. Please, please, please take care of yourself. And we look forward to maybe touching base with some folks early on in the fall to see what kinds of things that they have done quantitatively.
And share any ideas you might have with us about nonsense that you'd like to hear us talk about or do. You can go to the webpage and use the little email thing or Twitter or whatever. There are all these magical electronic things that Greg doesn't let me touch. I echo everything Greg said. This has been great fun. We're going to take a few weeks off and then reorient and come back at the start of the fall semester. Stay safe, stay healthy. Thank you so much for your time. Greg and I truly appreciate that. And we will catch up with you in a few weeks.
Thanks, everybody. Take care.
Bye-bye.
Shared another season's talent, play, and fun. Summer days will soon be over, soon the autumn starts. And tonight the memories whisper softly in our hearts.
Joy in hands and hearts and voices.
Yeah.